Hello, hello, and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today in the show...
When we face adversity or face challenges, that's when we really have to have the tools to get through those difficult times. Yeah, not only through my personal experiences, but as I mentioned, losing my best mate at a very young age, in a vulnerable age.
A young Australian advocating for youth mental health has won an award for his work. We have all the details. Also, how the food delivery platforms will look like after one of them is closing down. And later today...
Yeah, so I train with the Australian elite sprint men, the able bodies, and I'd like to think I train harder than all of them. And I'm sure if you ask any other para-athlete, Emily included, she'll tell you she trains harder than them.
A new documentary explores the resilience and courage of Paralympian athletes and their efforts from Paris 2024. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, a new report from the Grattan Institute has found the public hospital system wastes approximately $1.2 billion a year on avoidable spending. The report follows strong backlash from state and territory governments to a letter from Prime Minister Anthony Albanese urging them to rein in spending, which they argued was beyond belief considering the immense pressure they're under. The Wire's Maeve Groom spoke with senior associate of the Grattan Institute's health program and one of the authors of the report, Elizabeth Baldwin, about how public hospital spending got to this level.
So we took a look at the overall picture of hospital spending in Australia. This is public hospital spending. We put a lot of money into it as taxpayers. It's about $90 billion a year. So we want to make sure that we're getting the best value for every single one of those dollars. These are absolutely vital services. And we know that some people are missing out at the moment because they're stuck on waiting lists. They're not being seen on time in emergency departments. So our approach was to compare the cost of different treatments across different hospitals within the same state. So every hospital does things slightly differently, the way they organise their staff, how quickly they discharge patients, the number of automatic tests that are ordered when patients are staying in hospital. And we found that those differences add up to a big difference in how much each hospital is spending to deliver care. So for example, a hip replacement in Victoria varies by about $15,000 from one hospital to another. A caesarean section in Western Australia ranges from $12,000 more at the most expensive hospital compared to the least. And so when we added up all of those differences across the country, we think that there's about $1.2 billion of costs that could be reinvested in the system if the most expensive hospitals learned from the best in their state and were able to cut costs.
Prime Minister Albanese wrote to state and territory governments back in September urging them to rein in public spending. As a result, some of the states have reacted angrily, citing the intense pressure they are under. Is anyone right in this scenario, or does there need to be a balance between spending and easing the strain on the system?
That's right. It's a bit of column A, bit of column B in this one. Now, the states complain that the Commonwealth hasn't contributed its fair share over the past few years. And we think they're partly right on that. Since 2018, the Commonwealth has capped its funding growth, it's how much it contributes to public hospitals, at about 6.5% a year. Now, we've had periods of really high inflation, population growth over that period. So that doesn't actually cover a lot of new care and new admissions. So the state governments are right that the Commonwealth, you know, hasn't been contributing enough, and we think that needs to change. But it's also fair enough for the Commonwealth to be worried about the value it's getting for those extra dollars. One of the big findings from our report is that hospital budgeting has kind of become a sham. Every year, state governments set a budget for hospitals at the start of the year. And then at the end of every year, they bail them out. The hospitals run a deficit and more money needs to be poured into the system. So you can understand why the Commonwealth is worried that spending is growing every year. What's the assurance that we're getting great value for those dollars? So we think that there needs to be a bit of a bargain on both sides to break out of that deadlock.
What recommendations could be implemented by both the federal and state governments to fix the hospital budgets while not compromising the standard of patient care? You noted in the report that Australia could follow examples used within the UK and Canadian systems.
There's a lot that we can learn from other countries and even within Australia on ways to do care more efficiently, often even better for patients, while cutting costs. One example is hospital complications. A lot of people who go to hospital end up picking up an infection or a pressure injury, a bed sore, or some other complication. Now, that's terrible for patients. Obviously, you go to hospital to get well, not sicker, but it also adds to the cost of the stay. It often means people stay longer, they might need more treatment to treat that secondary complication. And these complications are things that some hospitals manage better than others. Some hospitals have put in place really effective programs to deal with them. And so that's one example of something that could be spread more widely. Another is learning from overseas. So in the UK, they've just done a big trial in London where doctors use AI note-taking software. And that means the doctors spend more time with patients, about 23% more time with patients, but the appointment lengths overall actually drop 8% less because there's less of that time spent on admin. So it's a win-win. So we think there's plenty of ideas around the system, but the reason they're not being spread is that these broken budgeting dynamics have kind of ruined hospitals' ability to invest in new projects like that. When they don't know how much their budget is for the whole year, it's harder for them to plan new projects, hire staff for a new initiative, and the incentive to really control costs is less when there's a bailout coming at the end of the year.
Elizabeth Baldwin from the Grattan Institute there, speaking with The Wire's Maeve Groom.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's national current affairs program.
Today, the Australian Mental Health Prize celebrates its 10th anniversary, recognising four outstanding Australians who have contributed to improving mental health. A quarter of Australians aged 16 to 24 are experiencing a mental illness with symptoms during adolescence. Army Captain, young cancer survivor and CEO of 25 Stay Alive, Hugo Tuvi, is one of the winners because of his lived experience and advocacy for youth mental health. The Wire's Rush B spoke to CEO of 25 Stay Alive Foundation, Hugo Tuvi, about his award.
Thank you very much. It's a great honour to be recognised in that category and win an award like that. It's obviously not something you set out to achieve, but for me, this is very much the ongoing work in this space for the last 13 years or so. So, yeah, it's great recognition.
What is the importance of focusing on youth mental health these days?
For me, it's very much putting a spotlight on the young adults, those young adults in their 20s and 30s that often don't really have the voice or the spotlight for their mental health. And it's something I've experienced over the years through my own personal lived experience with poor mental health, depression, and also losing my best mate to suicide in his early 20s. So for me to be able to share my experiences and deliver workshops and really connect with young adults who are navigating life's challenges is something I'm really passionate about, and it's something that I'll continue to do. And then hopefully if I can just help 1, 2, 5, 10 more people and keep providing a support network to those young adults who are potentially struggling and have someone to potentially talk to, or just have the avenue of know where, when and where to seek support. It's something I'll continue to do. And it's something that we're really passionate about.
How had your lived experience allowed you to become a youth advocate?
So as I briefly mentioned, it's something through my own personal experiences, which started out as a cancer battle with testicular cancer. Years later, I got diagnosed with bowel cancer, and I've really spent the last 12 years or so navigating significant health challenges, complex cancer treatments. I've had over 10 open abdominal surgeries. Most recently, I had another big chunk of bowel removed, and I'm now living with a permanent ileostomy or a stoma. And throughout all those many years of challenges with my physical health,
It was my mental health that also really struggled, but initially I didn't really do anything about that. And now I understand the importance of prioritising my mental health just as much as I've done everything I can to stay alive with my physical health. So it's through my own personal experiences of really learning the importance of why we need to look after our mental health, because when we face adversity or face challenges, that's when we really have to have the tools to get through those difficult times. Yeah, not only through my personal experiences, but as I mentioned, losing my best mate at a very young age, in a vulnerable age, in his early 20s to suicide, it was something I realised that we got to start doing this earlier on in life and often throughout those difficult years of our 20s and 30s, and when we're meant to have everything together, we got to really know how to and when to look after our mental health.
Hugo, why is early intervention so important?
Well, like anything in life, whether it's your physical health, your mental health, the earlier that you get onto something, the earlier that you treat something, you give yourself the best possible chance of getting help, getting better. The prevention of thousands, you know, versus the crisis of hundreds, we got to do more in the early intervention, the prevention space, because when something does happen, it is easier to treat and you'll have those tools to be able to treat it. So if you're listening to this and, you know, you're finding yourself that, you know, your mental health is at a pretty good stage, that's great, but keep it there. You've got to keep working on it, even if it's at a good stage, because when it does start to fluctuate and turn into poor mental health, you'll be able to get right onto it and it is far easier to treat.
Hugo, how will this prize help your advocacy?
Well, look, it's recognition for all the work that I've been doing for many years and I'll continue to do. But, you know, I guess it just allows me to put more of a spotlight on these important conversations, and receiving that award and the recognition of an award like that, you know, will allow me hopefully to get more conversations out there, to get my message out there, and hopefully to save and help more lives.
Hugo, is there anything else you would like to add?
If you've got any further interest or questions or queries about the work I do or the work that 25 Stay Alive does, which is my charity that I'm very proud of, visit the website 25stayalive.com and reach out. You know, we conduct workshops in communities, rural areas, sporting clubs. Would love to get out there, deliver one of our live workshops and do more in this space and hopefully spread some more important conversations. So I'd love to hear from you and thank you very much for having me on.
Hugo Tubby from 25 Stay Alive Foundation there, speaking with The Wire's Rush B. Listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on ACCC, to our friends in Armidale on Toon FM, and to the other side of the country to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. Last week, food delivery service Menulog announced it will cease its operations by the end of this month after 19 years. The company stated it's been facing difficult challenges along the way. However, with Menulog's closure, questions arise about what the future of food delivery platforms will look like. The Wire's Thomas Kutis asked University of Sydney Business School Emerging Scholar Research Fellow at the University of Sydney, Dr. Alex Bean, if the closure of Menulog changes the state of food delivery platforms.
That's a great question. I think it says more about the nature of the food delivery market than necessarily the state of the food delivery platform. So what it shows is that Menulog as an organization have been struggling to gain a significant and increase its market share within the Australian market. I think this also needs to be seen in the broader context of the parent company that owned Menulog, which had made some decisions in recent years to quite significantly expand overseas. And it found itself now in a position, having recently been taken over, that it's looking to consolidate in some of its markets. And with Menulog not having a dominant position in Australia, it looks like they've made the difficult decision to cease operations here.
Now, it was my understanding that one of the struggling components for Menulog was that it trialled some sort of employment model for its workers. How did that affect its business?
So that's a really good question as well. Menulog has tried to sort of different engagement model in comparison with some of its platforms. But having said that, we also need to understand that that was a relatively small-scale pilot project. So a few years ago, in 2021, the organization decided, sort of announced that it was going to move towards an employment model. It subsequently started a small employment pilot in Sydney, but that's not something it's rolled out to its entire workforce. So a significant proportion of the workforce on the ManuLog platform were still independent contractors, like you will see on other platforms in the industry, like Uber Eats and DoorDash, for example. But that organization, as an organization, ManuLog spent a lot of time and organizational resources to try and get that employment model to work. And it was effectively overtaken by other developments that we can see in the form of the employee-like reforms that the Albanese government introduced in 2024.
Well, just going on to its competitors and Uber, Uber has taken off in the last 10 or so years, first starting off as a cab service in 2010, then expanding as a rideshare platform, courier service, and now the delivery platform, Uber Eats, as you mentioned. Do you think that the closure of ManuLog was because it couldn't compete?
I think the decision for ManuLog, it's been competing with Uber for a significant period of time, as you mentioned. They've both been operating in Australia for over decade. What we have seen is that a lot of the market share that Uber was able to gain was to an extent at ManuLog's expense. We have seen other food delivery platforms entering and exiting the market in that period as well. And what we saw, for instance, a few years ago was that Deliveroo decided to leave the Australian market, whereas DoorDash, another platform, entered the market quite aggressively. But what we see in terms of the competition dynamics between these platforms, that the way for them to secure market share is by building brand awareness. And the way that they often do this is through basically subsidizing their operations and either giving consumers discounts or restaurants to try and get people to basically come onto their platforms and to create so-called network effect.
So will this closure sort of impact other restaurants and businesses, or do you think that it won't be as effective because they're using other services like Uber Eats or DoorDash?
Well, there's a question of the nature of the impact and the timeline at which we're looking here, right? So I think if we're just looking directly at substitution, there are other platforms that restaurants that have been using ManuLog could move to. But then the question is around how much does it cost them to use ManuLog versus an Uber Eats? And with there being less competition in the market, does it mean that an Uber Eats might be charging more in the future? Or a DoorDash, as an example, right? So I think there's the question around, is it better for consumers and restaurants that there's less competition? And I would argue probably it's not in their interest, because competition keeps prices down, gets the best sort of price for both the consumers and the restaurants. At the same time, there are alternatives in the markets that they can go to, and we can already see, even from some reporting by ManuLog itself in some of the submissions it was making to a Senate inquiry about a year ago, it indicated that around 75% of its workforce engaged in so-called multi-apping. So they weren't working exclusively for ManuLog, but they were working for ManuLog and some of its competitors. So it doesn't mean that those workers now no longer have access to any platform work. They can shift to competitors, and a lot of them were working for them, but it does mean they have less choice and less gigs available to them.
Dr. Alex Veen from the University of Sydney there, speaking with The Wire's Thomas Kouris. A new documentary explores the journey of the Australian Paralympic cycling team and their participation in the 2024 Paris Paralympics. The film Changing Track showcases not just the incredible sporting feats, but offers an intimate portrait of the struggle and preparation reaching one of the pinnacles of sport, witnessing the courage and collegiality of all involved. The Wire's Stephen Hill spoke with the film's director Tristan Kenyon and gold-winning Paralympians Emily Petricola and Corey Boddington, and asked the film's director how important it was to depict the different types of disabilities at the Paralympics.
My brother and I both co-wrote the documentary together, and one of the things that we wanted to do was explore the different reasons that someone might find themselves in the team, and we explored was effectively finding in Kane, Corey and Emily three different ways. So the first being an acquired injury. So that might that be a traumatic injury in the case of Corey, who had a series of accidents when he was younger, or for Emily, it was acquiring a disease, which was MS. Third way, being born with a congenital condition. So that was Kane, and being born with albinism affects his eyesight and puts him into the low vision category. Of course, there's many other ways that, you know, you can be in Paris.
So we also have here our multi-gold medal record-holding cyclist, Emily Bichkova. You were diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, which upturned your life and your successful career. That must have been a difficult time adjusting to the limitations of MS.
Yeah, the limitations weren't necessarily immediate. The thing with MS is it builds up over time, depending on how many relapses you have and how many plaques you've got, either in your brain or on your spinal cord. But I was really unlucky that the first 3 years were pretty horrible for me. I was pretty sick pretty consistently, so every 3 or 4 months I'd be back in hospital getting massive doses of steroids.
I mean, that's the unknown aspect too, of not knowing what's happening in front. That must be really difficult. Just, you know, how do you sort of structure your life?
Well, I remember the first neurologist that I'd saw who actually gave me the diagnosis had said to me at the time, look, we won't put you on medication. We can't, because you've only had one clinical relapse. You need to have two to be put on medication. You'll just have to wait for that to happen. And I said, well, I've got a trip overseas booked in 4 months to Europe. Am I going to be able to take that trip, or should I cancel it? He said, oh, it's up to you. He goes, but what usually happens early in the disease is that people go blind. So that might happen while you're away. You'll have to think about that. And I remember just thinking, this doesn't feel that great to me, just to sit around and wait for something to happen.
So how important was cycling to be able to, you know, be able to re-engage with community, to be able to keep fit?
To be honest, it wasn't so much the community initially for me. It was more about regaining a sense of my identity from before I was sick, because I'd always been really fit, active, healthy throughout my entire life. Being able to get into cycling, which was a suggestion of a friend of mine, it wasn't my idea, that really connected me back into a piece of who I was before. And that sort of started this process of me reclaiming who I was again, rather than sort of just being at the behest of the illness to a degree. And I was pretty depressed. And so getting back into sport was the first time where I'd been able to really recognise where I'd been through the journey, and allowed me to then start to step away from that part of my life and sort of step back into who I was and who I could now still be.
So we also have here another gold medalist and record holder, making me feel a bit inadequate here. So Kobe Boddington, who suffered a brain injury from a motocross accident, and he's now known as the Flying Burrito. And also, can you tell us a little bit about your journey becoming a gold medalist?
I had my first injury when I was about 10 years old. So I got hit by a car, I was playing cricket, hit the ball, six and out. On the way back, I got cleaned up by a car. It hit on my right side of the body, so I had a heap of damage on my right side. Fast forward, I'm getting better from that. All I want to do is go back, play footy with my mates, go surfing. But my body never fully got better. So then when I was 15, I had a motocross accident. I ended up in a coma for 3 weeks. More damage to the right side of my body. Had to learn to walk and talk again. My injuries got really bad on my right side. Like, my right arm completely got frozen. And 15 years later, it's only at about 50% strength.
While spectators get to see the finished product of bicycles moving effortlessly at rapid speed, and which a lot of preparation goes into the foundation for, you know, the success on the track, can you tell us a little bit about how arduous the training regime is?
Yeah, so I train with the Australian elite sprint men, the able bodies, and I'd like to think I train harder than all of them. And I'm sure if you ask any other para-athlete, Emily included, she'll tell you she trains harder than them.
I don't think I train harder, but it's at least as hard. I think that the training is by its nature harder for us, because we're trying to do it despite something that's not quite right with our body. I don't want to discredit the work that they do, because they work incredibly hard as well, but we do it with a bigger challenge in front of us.
Yes, that was correct.
So what's it like? I mean, you've both got careers. Yes, I mean, that must be hard. I'm assuming you have to get up really early.
The key is to get into bed nice and early, because my day starts at about 4 o'clock. So I get to the gym, do my couple hours in the gym, and then I'm straight to work. I'm either working or working.
Different sort of work.
So
the idea of free time is a bit of a...
life takes a real hit when you've chosen this.
Tristan Kenyon, Emily Petricola and Corey Boddington there, speaking with The Wire's Stephen Hill. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you're in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. If you would like to listen to any of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Jagera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. I'm Eduardo Jordan. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.